This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com and RobertsonTrainingSystems.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast, everyone. This is episode number 57. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and we have a great show for you this week, as always. I know I say that every week, but especially this week. First off, we have with us Jimmy Smith of JimmySmithTraining.com. How's it going, Jimmy?
It's going good. How's everybody doing?
We're doing fantastic, I hope. I mean, it's a great Sunday morning, and as always, we have our resident lifeguard, Keith Scott,
on the
beach
guys?
Patrolling.
No, I did that yesterday. I'm back.
Yeah, I found a great PSA with G.I. Joe for treading water, and I really wanted to play it before the show started because it was priceless. It was just, I forget the guy's name, that you know, the scuba guy from G.I. Joe. But anyways, let's get to our major guest this week, and that's Eric Cressy. You know him from Magnificent Mobility. You know him from his many articles on T-Nation, Building the Efficient Athlete series. You know him from the official, or the ultimate off-season training manual. And it's my pleasure to get Eric Cressy back on the show. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, it's been almost a year since you've been on last, and really it's been a big year for you. I mean, you've been all over the place. You moved back to Massachusetts. I guess that was more than a year ago, but
It was last August, right at the beginning of August. So it was a really, really good switch, one of the best decisions I've ever made. So it's been a fun year.
It's good to be back in the Boston. I mean, you got all these great Boston sports teams, especially the Boston Celtics, which I have to mention every week. They're going to be having a great season this year after they get Kevin Garnett.
Is that going to happen? I don't know. We'll keep our fingers crossed. How's that?
We'll see. I think Jefferson can still be great. And just calling in right now is Jen Heath. You know her from JenHeath.com. And Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And we got our whole crew here, minus Tony Gentilcore, who is playing supposedly Dungeons & Dragons in the living room. I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but I'm sure Tony can talk about that next week.
You might have diversified and be reading Harry Potter right now. I'll find out for you after the show's over.
Oh, I hear he's excited about the new book.
Oh, I'm positive he is.
That's great.
Well, put it, when we were at the seminar a couple weeks ago, we were all talking about training and everything, and he was talking about Harry Potter, so he's definitely juiced up about it.
Exactly.
That's okay. I'm going to pirate the discussions to the Transformers today, so.
It's a good movie.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Great good. Show.
It's really good.
Well, let's jump into the FitCast topics real quickly, and then we'll get into the Q&A with Eric. First off, this is the last week for the Fat Loss Pros deal through the FitCast.com. If you want to go to the FitCast.com, you can buy the Fat Loss Pros interview package through there. And again, you get 3 free months of the FitCast Insider with it. So you get a boatload of interviews to download right off the bat. You can spend your whole next week listening to the great experts that we've had on both Fat Loss Pros and also the FitCast Insider. Secondly, I want to talk about Jimmy Smith's article on TNation.com. Jimmy, do you want to just tell everyone a little bit about that if they haven't checked it out?
Basically, real quick, all that article is, it just talks about some more productive ways that I think people should be using to get more out of their training sessions. It seems like a lot of times people go and they're kind of not that focused on what they need to do at hand. So they get in there and they end up spending a lot of wasted time, a lot of wasted energy in the weight room. So really the whole premise of the article was just 9 ways that people can go and get kind of more bang for their buck. And it was really generally written for the people that have like 45 minutes to train. They have to get in, they have to get out. They can't play around, do any cute stuff. So I just tried to make it for people that really want to compact their training sessions, but at the same time, get the best results possible.
Good stuff, and it's not just talking about that you don't have to do a warm-up or foam rolling. I guess that's a common misconception.
I didn't say we don't have to do a warm-up. That's the thing. A lot of people are saying I was totally against the warm-up, and I'm not. I'm totally for a warm-up. I just think there's a lot of people that get – like I've even seen it. There's people that go and they do a warm-up, and they stay on the warm-up for way too long. Mm-hmm. After they've already – people throw a lot of excessive stuff in that they don't need to do. I don't know if everybody else has seen that. But from my point of view, people are throwing in excess stuff they don't need to do, and it's actually hindering their training because they're not able to go and train. I'm not saying we should just go and jump on, you know, the flat bench and bang out light sets of dumbbell presses and get the heavy stuff, but at the same time, we need to kind of condense everything if that's what, you know, is needed.
Well put. Next up, now on the website, we actually have Flash Audio and a Flash Audio player, so you can play each episode of the FitCast right on the site. And it's a nice little one flash player. You'll see a little button that says audio or something like that, but I'll make sure to point towards it when you're in the show notes. But you can just press play, leave your browser open, listen to the show right from there, or you can always download it by right-clicking on that or subscribing through iTunes as always. Next up, again, on the FitCast.com, we're going to have weekly polls. Right now I'm just pulling just some fun stuff about where everyone's listening from. If you want to jump on that, it's just in the sidebar of the FitCast.com. You can do that anytime you want up until the next time we record the show, and I'll announce the results every week. Next up, live shows with call-ins are coming soon. I have it all set up. I'm just going to figure out when this is the first time we're going to do it, so we're going to have to plan ahead about a week or two for this. And hopefully, for our next guest, you're going to be able to actually call in with your questions. You can listen to the show live. Up to 1,000 people can listen live at a time. And it should promote for a great little atmosphere. And hopefully, we'll have some great questions. And all you pranksters out there, don't even try it, because I can always edit it out. Next up, I think this is Jimmy Smith's fault. Because last week I got 3 more emails about people asking if I was Canadian. This is not true. This is crap.
You sound Canadian, dude.
No, I don't.
I can see you dressing up like a little Mountie. I mean, I don't know.
Be a long commute to the gym, Kev.
It would be. It's already half an hour. I mean, that'd be more like 3 or 4 hours, which is not something I'm looking towards. But I'm not Canadian. Just...
I know it kills you, Jimmy, for me to side with Kevin, but I don't think that he sounds Canadian.
You don't see as Canadian? Because when he says, like, about, and he says...
I'm Canadian.
Are you Canadian?
Am I?
Yeah, are you?
No!
Well, see,
there's nothing wrong with being Canadian, but Eric Leighton, a good buddy of mine, he's Canadian. I have a lot of Canadian friends. My father-in-law... Dad is Canadian, and I don't think Kevin sounds Canadian.
Yeah, just ask Cassandra Forth.
I was going to say, when I compare him and Cass, like how they say certain words, they sound like just
alike.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, Cass is hilarious. Okay, well.
And I know Keith, Keith agrees with me. Keith, don't stay shy.
No, even if I did think that Kevin sounded Canadian, I would still have to side with him, just because I know how much it kills you, Jimmy.
Oh,
well, I take a little bit of responsibility because it was we sparked it at, in Providence. We were talking about, yeah. My girlfriend asked if Kevin was Canadian, and I said I don't think he is, and but he does sound a little bit Canadian.
All right, thank you. Whatever. Anyways, last.
It's not Kev. It's not.
It's
not
a bad thing.
I love the Canadians up there. I mean,
you enunciate very well, and that's important.
I know I have problems with some words. I have some kind of speech impediment that I'm fighting through right now.
Yeah, it's called Tourette's, but it's not, you know, it's very easy to get rid of.
All right. It's ganging up on Kevin this week. But anyways, lastly, our articles for this week. Does anyone want to talk about the articles that they're going to be writing for the FitCast.com this week at all?
I can if... you know, I don't know if anybody's going to jump in. Kev, I'm going to try to, you know, and I'm halfway through one right now, I'm going to try to really talk about the kinetic chain and just real basically how everything affects everything else. I know that's been written about to death in various forums and things like that, but I think I'm going to try to condense it. I've been getting a lot of emails about hips and ankles and all those other things that we always talk about. And
yeah,
you know,
Keith, you've been posting up a storm in the comments section. I mean, it's been great. Everyone who's been reading the articles, you guys have been posting in the comments, and we really do encourage that. It causes for some great conversation back and forth.
Yeah, it has been. And from that, I've gotten a lot of emails about, you know how the ankles affect the knees and the hips and so on. So I'm going to kind of talk a little bit, but I'm going to do more of a case study on some of the people have actually seen walk in and have issues. And, you know, for example, a doctor or a physical therapist, you know, has looked at the problem instead of the overall issue of the chain. And when you look at the chain and start to look at the, you know, from the feet all the way up, you can start to, you know, obviously if you do things the right way, can get a person better a lot quicker. So I'm going to kind of talk about the kinetic chain of how one area affects the other area and so on.
Yeah, Keith, your articles have been getting a lot of attention. We actually have had some people out there posting your articles, or not your articles, but links to your articles on other sites, and people are really enjoying them. So, I mean, good. By all means, great job, man.
Good.
And I guess I'm just going to be writing this week about things you can do instead of sitting on your ass in front of the computer, things you can do while doing work, but also staying active at the same time, even things you can do while sitting down, watching TV on the couch. I'm going to give you some easy ways to just get some steady-state cardio stuff in. It might cost you a little bit of money, but I'm going to keep it under like $50. And you can find some of these things at a yard sale for $5, $10. I mean, I found one of the things I'm going to talk about at a yard sale for $5. So some things that you can just keep a lookout for if you just can't seem to find that extra 30 minutes to just get in some walking every day. This is going to be a good way to do it and to keep the blood flowing. And also, I want to quickly mention that for Jen's article this week, it's going to be pushed back to Monday because I don't want to post it on Saturday. We kind of were behind a day on this week's articles, but we're going to have it on Monday as well as my article. But I will post mine late at night, so Jen's will be up all day.
And I'm going to try to stop teasing everybody about writing about creatine and then not doing it. I really just want it to be a good.
Do it.
I don't want to. I want to be able to have a lot of time to work on it. So I'm really going to try for Friday to have my creatine article up, but I'll make everyone a deal. They have to post lots of comments because that is a good discussion right there. So
absolutely. Well, fair enough. Before we do jump into the questions with Eric, I want to quickly mention our sponsors for this week. First off, as always, Craig Ballantyne at TurbulenceTraining.com. Boost muscle growth and blowtorch body fat at TurbulenceTraining.com. Make sure to check out the monthly new workout at ttmembers.com. If you're not a member there, you should definitely check it out and see what he's offering. He's really giving you a new workout every month, so it's really cool stuff there. And again, as always, Mike Robertson, robertsontrainingsystems.com, where you can pick up his great products like Inside Out, Bulletproof Knees, even Magnificent Mobility and Building the Efficient Athlete, all that stuff is in his store. And as well, you can get a bunch of that stuff in Eric's store as well. Just you should have those sites bookmarked anyway. I don't know why you don't. Well, let's jump into the questions with Eric for this week. Eric, first off, this is a question that I've really seen develop with your guys at the gym, and I want you to just start and talk about the story about the baseball players that you've been training.
All right. Well, basically, you know, it's been kind of a lot of fun for me because it, in a lot of ways, blends kind of two passions that I have. In the past, obviously, I've done a lot of work with corrective exercise and also in terms of performance enhancement, obviously, with various athletes. The nice thing about dealing with a baseball population is, in a lot of senses, you blend the two things because overhead throwing athletes are really an at-risk population. You know, the angular velocities that you see at the joints with throwing are, you know, as my buddy John Paloff talked about, he said they're inhumane. There's absolutely nothing right about throwing a baseball overhead. James Andrews, the notorious rotator cuff surgeon, did a study with 73 pitchers, and he found that all 73 of them had labral fraying in their shoulder. So we know that the motion in and of itself is something that destroys a shoulder, and that's why a lot of guys have shoulder surgery. But we also know that there's a lot we can do from a training standpoint to, you know, counteract those problems and really work to improve efficiency in the pitching motion and obviously, you know, the other positions of the game as well. So, you know, obviously, I have to give a ton of credit actually to Carl Valley. You know, I have a big background in soccer and basketball and doing other stuff. And when I moved up here last year, you know, Carl actually introduced me to, you know, one guy and his very supportive father. And you know, he was the shortstop for Lincoln Sudbury. And he brought in his buddy, who was a catcher. And long story short, those two guys have blossomed into a program. We've got 21 athletes from Lincoln Sudbury, which is the number 6 ranked team on the entire East Coast. And they won the Massachusetts Division I state championship with like a 27-1 record this year. So it was a huge deal because this was really only their second year in Division I. And we had the Massachusetts player of the year, a pitcher who went 12-0 with 9 shutouts. So it was a really great time. But, you know, I think, you know, more than anything was the, you know, watching the changes in the culture over the past year, just working with the guys. You know, a lot of baseball players traditionally are guys who don't think they need the weight room, you know, especially in the pitching population. Likewise, you have other guys that are just kind of doing the foo-foo rubber tubing stuff and not training their lower body and just doing push-ups for their upper body. And in reality, you know, we kind of shifted that culture around to one where we, you know, we had guys practically ready to kick the door down to the gym. So it's been a lot of fun and really kind of the blossoming of an empire, and definitely a, you know, a blast for me to train and watch the guys really make great progress.
This is somewhat off topic, but and it might be a stupid question, but have you are any of the kids on the team submarine pitchers?
And no, you know, you don't get those as often in the younger ranks, although, you know, there actually is a kid nearby in Massachusetts who's kind of notorious for that, but as a general thumb, it's probably a safer throwing motion when you drop down the side, because, I mean, you look at softball pitchers notoriously, I mean, they can go out and throw every day simply because of the release point and the, you know, leg drive being a little bit differently, that you can take a lot of the stress off of those passive restraints like the ligaments and the, you know, labrum, and put more on the active restraints, you know, i.e. the muscles and the tendons. So it's presumably a safer motion. I don't think you'll ever see it being taught to kids, but it's a very, very good question, Kev.
Again, as always, if anyone else on the show wants to throw in questions, feel free to jump in. I'm just going down a list of some stuff that we got from our
I can go. If Keith wants to throw some out, that's great. I can also go into more detail. I mean, notoriously, you know, the baseball population is one that we babied, if you really think about it. You know, what does a major league pitcher do? They pitch every fifth day and then they sit around for four, you know, traditionally, and that's why you see a lot of fat pitchers in the major leagues, unfortunately. And, you know, in the past they've talked about, you know, some guys run pole sprints, some guys do long distance, you know, jogging, things like that. We've tried to build a culture where our pitchers know that they're going to lift the day after they start. You know, you want to consolidate that stress, and we're also going to be throwing in recovery things. Guys are doing soft tissue work, they're doing active recovery exercise, things that they can do to regenerate faster. And as a whole, if you really look at some of the brighter minds in professional baseball, and you know, in terms of geographically, you know, the guys who throw the most are generally the ones that who are the healthiest for the long haul. If you know Liam Mazzoni, who is the guy that was down in Atlanta back in the day when they had Glavin, they had Smoltz, they had Avery, and Maddox during their big run. I mean, he's notorious for really liking to push pitching volume. His guys throw a lot, and you know, there you have three of the most durable pitchers in the major leagues to this day. They're all pitching well into their 40s. So I mean, that's a huge deal, and you know, kind of speaks volumes for what can happen. Same thing happened years ago when Byung-Young Kim came over from the Far East. What did we do? We started shutting his throwing volume down, and he actually wound up having more shoulder problems. So it's a kind of an interesting dynamic, but I think we've gotten to the point where we baby pitchers so much, and we don't really have a true frame of reference for knowing exactly how much is too much. I mean, you'll see recommendations for 17 and 18 year old little leaguers in terms of pitch counts, and that's something that actually came up with one of our guys in the playoffs this year. He threw a ton of pitches. You know, I think he threw 509 pitches over 16 days, which is 150 more than anybody in the major leagues during that period. So it's a pretty insane amount. But what we have to consider is, you know, all of these pitch counts are based on what they've seen in little leaguers, you know, kids who are 17 and 18. But nobody ever speaks to the question, you know, did these 17 and 18 year old kids they were looking at when they formulated these studies, were these kids resistance training, or were they just kind of, you know, going to the park and hanging out on off days? So it's definitely a big, you know, dynamic, because you know that muscular recruitment patterns are going to be different in more experienced pitchers who have lifted, versus, you know, novice pitchers who generally are more inefficient with the motion. So it's not just about throwing hard anymore. It's about, you know, being efficient and throwing hard with the right muscles.
Eric, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the pitch counts, for I know people see on the news all the time that kids are younger and younger and they're getting shoulder surgeries at 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. do you think they should be limiting the amount of pitchers for the younger teenage group, like between the ages of like 12 and 16?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that they need to be watching out for, simply because at that age, typically kids haven't prepared themselves properly. They're going out and they're playing, and they're not really training to play. I think that's a shift that, you know, hopefully will come around in the next couple months, or next couple years, I should say, simply because, you know, there's more opportunities for younger guys to actually lift weights and prepare with guys who kind of know their stuff along these lines. But yeah, I think pitch counts are a very, very important thing. I know Mike Stair did some research at Boston University, and we actually talked about it in one of my old Lou newsletters about the optimal like number of pitches during a season for kids who really weren't prepared. There's kind of a minimum threshold you need to reach, and then a threshold that you don't want to exceed. So it's definitely a balancing act. But when you get up to that 17, 18 year old age, where kids are getting ready to pitch the next level, be that college or drafted right out of high school, all of a sudden, they've got to be ready sooner than later to kind of perform at a high level and possibly do so in increased volume. So, I think it's our responsibility in this industry to really prepare them for that. And I don't think us babying them by, falling back on pitch counts excessively is really going to do them any good in the long run. I still think the pitch counts are very, very useful, but I think that we need to take a little bit more of an open-minded perspective when we realize that a lot of these pitch counts were formulated on what are essentially untrained populations. And, if somebody did that with a resistance training study, it would be garbage right away, but all of a sudden you do it in a little leaguer, and it's suddenly the holy grail of training.
Keith, did you want to jump in there?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask. He kind of covered it real quick, but Eric and I talked up in Providence a lot about baseball, and I have a lot of baseball, especially pitchers right now. But I was going to ask Eric, how much soft tissue work right now are you doing with especially your pitchers, and do you feel that the soft tissue work is something that needs to be done more in that population?
I definitely think so.
Yeah, around the shoulder area.
We spend a lot of time working on the posterior capsule. Basically, what we see a lot in overhead throwing athletes is something called glenohumeral internal rotation deficit. Essentially, what you have is, when you actually pitch, when you go really far back in the cocking motion, what you're doing is you're increasing external rotation range of motion. So these guys develop a tremendous amount of external rotation. That's a good thing in terms of developing force, but it's a bad thing in the sense that on one hand it actually it decreases the amount of internal rotation they have, if that makes sense, because you get stiffness in that posterior capsule, which is your infraspinatus, your teres minor, your posterior deltoid, and then all of a sudden you're lacking that internal rotation range of motion on the pitch and the follow through itself. So where that becomes a problem is if you have stiffness in the shoulder, you're going to look elsewhere to get that range of motion. So that's why you're seeing, more and more Tommy John surgeries, right? They're taking that elbow and they're making it a hypermobile joint when in reality it should be a very stable hinge. So we're seeing UCL problems, and, guys are doing, 100 times as many UCL surgeries as they've seen in the past. I got a chart right here in front of me, speaking back to the pitch counts. There were 28 orthopedic surgeons that compiled a chart recommending pitch counts for 17 to 18-year-old kids. They said on one day's rest, 28 pitches is the max, 2 days, 63. 3 days rest, 82 pitches, and on 4 days rest, 106 pitches. So presumably over the course of 16 days, you're looking at 400 to 24 pitch maximum. Our guy threw 509, I believe it was, over the course of that period. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a stretch, but what you have to consider is he doing it long term and all that. And I think that a lot of people got a little bit bent out of shape over something that wasn't really necessary to get it worked up about. But the important thing is that he didn't change his mechanics during that time, right? If kids are all of a sudden, they're throwing markedly different and they feel different and their arm hurts, that's when you need to shut it down, especially. And ideally, you head it off before then. With our guy, he didn't have any problems with that. His mechanics stayed the same, and actually, it was good for him in the sense that he learned to use a lot more of his off-speed stuff to get the similar results. So.
Yeah, and I think Eric just said that it was very important that his pitchers, and if you're trained the right way, you're going to train pitchers to be durable. And durable means over the long haul. And you know, his pitchers threw 500 and some pitches, but they were durable. They did it all the right way, the same mechanics. If they have good coaches and good people with them, they're going to make sure they're still throwing the same way and everything's cool.
Yeah.
And that all comes from durability and the type of training. You have to think that probably 80 to 90% of pitchers out there aren't being trained the right way at all.
Exactly. So, and you want to hear something wild is actually, go ahead, Keith, finish up. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so when you bring those numbers into it and people start to criticize, they're criticizing off of 80% of the population that's not being trained and not the 10 or 20% like, you know, the kids Eric had, for example, that were being trained the right way for the long haul. So as you get smarter coaches and smarter trainers and things like that, you're going to see, you know, that pitch count possibly go up, and you're going to see a lot more success out there instead of, you know, the surgeries and the problems going along with it.
Yeah, and I think the wild thing about it is I have his kids' testing numbers on hand. Kevin, he's a great kid. He's going to University of Maine on a scholarship next year to pitch for them. Kevin was 4-5 as a junior. Basically, I got him. We put 14 pounds on him in the off season. But I think the most significant thing I can really look at, 14 inches on his broad jump, you know, things like that. Wow. When we first, one of the tests I use a lot of our guys is a single leg triple jump. Okay, so what it is three jumps all on one leg in rapid succession. So we're looking at a lot of things. One, I'm looking at, you know, it's actually a pretty good indicator of athleticism just by getting an idea of how much spring does someone actually get in their ankle. You know, do they have good stiffness so that they can just kind of store that elastic energy well and get the next jump going the way they want to. So I look at that. I look at, overall, you know, force production. So how far in terms of jumps do they get? And we use three jumps simply because it kind of magnifies things. It allows us to get a bigger difference if something's in place. And perhaps most importantly, what we can look at is a side-to-side asymmetry. So in a sport that's traditionally unilateral dominant, you're hoping to avoid seeing issues where, one side is remarkably stronger than the other. When we first got him, he had a 16-inch difference side to side. So that's about 5 1/3 inches on every jump, if you look at the difference. So that was a guy who was 4-5 throwing 80 as a junior, and it explains probably why he didn't get some crazy recruiting coming out of his junior year. Conversely, I went out and tested him at the end of his off season. Right before he went to preseason, that discrepancy was down to 2 inches, which is basically non-significant. If you really think about it, anything over 15% is a huge red flag. He was down to 2 inches side to side, so you're looking at basically like a 3/4 of an inch at most error on each jump or difference on each jump, and that could very well be testing error, just chance things. Here's the interesting thing, though. I tested him after his season. This is basically 3 months and 19 days later, his difference side to side was 1 inch. So after going through an entire season, that speaks very much to efficiency. If you read Gray Cook's stuff or hear him talk in seminar, he's, I think, done some studies actually with the Indianapolis Colts, and he's found that some of the best predictors of injury are asymmetry side to side. So this guy, after going out and probably throwing over 1,000 pitches this year, going through a full season, hitting from one side of the plate, he was playing first base on off days, he had a 1 inch asymmetry side to side, and to me that's the thing that sustained him. When I test the other guys from that same pitching staff, who are the guys who are the 3 and 4 starters, you're looking at differences side to side of 1 foot 6 inches after a season. Guys are at least 7 to 8 inches, and that to me kind of screams asymmetry, and that's why they weren't necessarily throwing as hard at the end of the season, and they weren't sustaining it as much. So
Eric, I might have another dumb question, but what is considered a pitch when you're counting pitches? Is it like an in-game throw?
Yeah, it's an in-game. I think it's actually only to the plate. I'm not even sure that they count throws over first base and things like that, which is a very good question. Basically, I don't know that they count throws over to first base, but in the high school population, what you have to consider is, a lot of these guys are playing the field on their off days. Their number two starter is a left fielder. Their first starter plays first base when he's not pitching, and you got a center fielder who comes in and pitches sometimes too. So these guys, all of a sudden, are doing some more and more throwing on off days. So it's a very, very different situation. Another one that's actually something that people overlook all the time is, think about what a catcher does. I mean, how many major league or college or even high school catchers do you know that just kind of lob the ball back to the mound? Mm-hmm. Not many. Most of them stand up and fire. Like, our guy's probably throwing 75, 80 at least on every throw back to the mound. And, he's got to catch for all the starters. He's not just catching for their one stud pitcher, like, the pitcher gets, to play every fifth day. Doesn't work that way. So he's probably doing more throwing on the than anybody on the squad. Yet catchers are notoriously the ones that we just, you know, assume are tough guys and we don't need to worry about them. In reality, you know, those guys are throwing a lot more than anybody on the field, and they're also taking a pretty good beating on their knees. So we have to make a lot of modifications with them in terms of, I don't squat my catchers in season. We'll do a lot more pulling. We might do some box squatting, but as a rule of thumb, you know, we want to, you know, basically get them out of that stance a little bit.
Is there anything Eddie wanted to add before we move on?
Well, I just wanted to, real quick, just, I mean, I was on a lot of the rules committees last year when I worked at the high school. It's actual throws over the plate during the game. Warm-ups don't count. Throws the first don't count. You know, technically even box don't count, depending on who's taking the pitch counts. But, I mean, Eric was right on. It's right over the plate during the game. So, you know, the important thing, like he said, you know, you got warm-ups going on, you got, you know, bullpen going on, all those extra things, they aren't counted. So if you take all those into consideration, especially early March when the season started, it's still cold out, guys are taking their time getting warm, there's a lot more pitches being thrown than just what's in the game.
That's a very good point.
Let's jump into one of our listener questions, and I'm sorry if I butcher your name, I really apologize, but I'm going to go with Udy. I think that's safe. In your blog and your previous article on T-Nation's Shoulder Savers Part 2, you briefly spoke about shoulder issues that normally occur in overhead throwing athletes. You state that the non-dominant side responds well to added mobility work, whereas the dominant side benefits more from extra comprehensive scapular and rotator cuff stability training. Could you elaborate more on what you mean by that and how it could be implemented practically by trainers training? And could you, I almost went through that whole thing without screwing up the question, but it could be implemented practically by trainers working with overhead throwing athletes.
Well, actually, that speaks kind of to that glenohumeral internal rotation deficit I was talking about. Right? You have hypermobility and external rotation on that throwing side. So for those guys, what we're typically going to do is it's kind of a three-pronged approach to working directly on the humerus, at least. You're going to want to loosen up that posterior capsule with some soft tissue work. We usually have the guys roll around on a lacrosse ball a little bit. Some of them do well with manual therapy. From there, you're looking at like a sleeper stretch, which is just a stretch in internal rotation that's been around for quite a while. And you know, if you're going to do one thing with an overhead throwing athlete, make sure that you do sleeper stretches. And then, you know, the third thing would be a prone internal rotation, which is probably the best subscap exercise that I know of. Michael Hope taught that to me. You know, traditional subscap stuff is just, you know, it doesn't really separate out pec major. It's pretty easy to compensate with that. But a prone internal rotation, which is you know, basically face down on a stretching table, just going through internal rotation from kind of a 90-90 position. Kind of hard to explain, but that one is kind of our bread and butter movement. Likewise, we're doing a lot of stuff in terms of just basic scapular stability stuff. Lots of seated rows. We do a ton of chin-ups, things along those lines. Anything we can do, prone trap raises to really stabilize the scapula and get them moving effectively in an upward rotation pattern. So basically our two big targets in that context are lower trap and serratus anterior. So lower trap is going to be your prone trap raises, your behind the neck band pull aparts, and then for more of a serratus anterior type thing, you're looking at scap push-ups. You might be doing some dumbbell protractions, something along those lines, basically just to ensure that, you know, when they are getting their hand overhead, that the scapula is fixed in the right place and the muscles stabilizing it are strong enough. You know, obviously there's a huge link between your thoracic spine and your scapula and your obviously your shoulder. So we're always doing a lot of thoracic spine extension and rotation range of motion work. You know, basic, you know, as much as I hate the term, core stability work. And then definitely a lot of mobility on the opposite hip and ankle. So really one of the best things you can do is just kind of get them out of their comfort zone. You know, one of the things we'll do with some of our pitching guys, you know, if traditionally their right leg is their plant leg, we'll do you know, a little bit more single leg stuff with the left leg as their plant leg. So that tends to iron things out a little bit more. But generally speaking, you can actually tell somebody's like handedness pattern just by how comfortable they are on single leg movements. It's pretty pronounced difference.
This might be going off topic a little bit, but since we don't have Tony here, and because Jimmy's such a stickler, but I want you to let the people out there know, as I've been training at Excel for almost 3 months, it's coming up on 3 months now, and How's my posture? Is it all right? Eric?
Oh, you're talking to me? I thought you were asking Jimmy.
No, I'm asking you. No, because yeah, Jimmy's always saying, you know what, Lurbio, just make fun of your posture all day. That's all I have to do.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's getting better. It's definitely getting better. So numbers are going up, and you're not bleeding on your shins every time you try to deadlift anymore. So I think that in and of itself is a pretty good sign that you're headed in the right direction. But no, I'm definitely moving a lot better overall and looking better too. So yeah, I'm very pleased with the progress.
Yeah, it's been great so far. If anyone's in the Massachusetts area, you should definitely or even make the drive from New Hampshire around and try to train at Excel. It's such a great atmosphere, and I talk about it every week how much fun we really do have there, and I'm seeing results, and that's great to see after kind of having some stalling.
Hey, Kev, I thought you were going to post some more videos of your training.
I do have a video of a death circuit. I'll post in the show notes if
all right, we need to see that.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
The best part is that we had a couple of guys over visiting from the UK, and so you got the English commentary in the background with the nice thick accents. So it kept things interesting. But yeah, you did a good job. Everyone's kind of indifferent to it if they're just watching from around the facility. Kevin's meanwhile just huffing and puffing for about 2.5 minutes, I think it was.
Yeah, this wasn't at the beginning of the work. I'm not making excuses, but that was at the end of a pretty vigorous workout.
Yeah, and you did three of them too. So
yeah, that was just the last two.
Yeah, I'll give you a gold star for the day, though.
Thanks.
Gold star. Nice.
All right, let's keep pushing through the questions. The next one comes from Cindy, and she says, "Hi, FitCast team. I love your show and being an insider." And see, there's a little plug. "I have made a lot of progress with my pelvic imbalances from Eric Cressy's comments on the show and his Magnificent Mobility DVD. I'm finally stable enough to do lunges and step-ups. However, now I get pain on the inside of my knee and my ankle cracks / crunches." I hope it doesn't crunch too much. "My chiropractor verified that I'm pulling too hard on the joints, so they mildly misalign. Do you have any ideas how I can build stability in my lower legs? Unfortunately, barefoot isn't an option. I wear orthotics for my flat feet and a 1/4 lift in one shoe to compensate for a short leg." And she finishes up by saying, "Yep, I'm 39 years old, overweight mess, but I get stronger every week now." And that's, Cindy, that's what it's all about. It's all about progress. So, Eric, what's your take on that?
Agree completely. You know, a couple of things that jump out at me on that are, actually, there are three things. I kind of wrote them down as you went. First one is, it was towards the end, she mentioned she was an overweight mess. Really, you know, anything we do in life is all about relative strength, right? So, you know, anything that your muscles don't have the strength to decelerate are going to be things that go thrown on the passive restraints of your body, right? So if all of a sudden the inside of her knees, you know, getting hurt and things like that, a lot of times it's just a function of getting the body weight down so that you don't have to support quite as much load on every exercise that you do. Along those same lines, she mentioned lunges and step-ups. I'm assuming that when most people say lunges, they mean forward lunges. Traditionally, that's what you see. What's tricky about a forward lunge is if you look at your single leg classifications, Mike Boyle actually introduced me to this a while back, and it's been great. You know, I just kind of took the progressions from there, is that, you know, a forward lunge is a very decelerative movement, right? You have to lunge forward, you have to decelerate and come back up. Compare that to a reverse lunge where you step back. There's much less deceleration. In reality, it's more of an accelerative movement. So I think for someone like this, you know, rather than going to the lunges and the step-ups where there's going to be a fair amount of pounding either on the front leg as you step forward on a lunge or on the back leg as you step down on a step-up, you know, I think they'd be better off looking to things like reverse lunges where you step back, the front foot is fixed, and also just, you know, split squat isometric holds, things along those lines. And that's where a lot of things kind of shake free. You know, pain along the inside of my knee, that's kind of a diffuse statement. You know, we could be talking about a medial meniscus issue. If that's the case, then, you know, she's got joint line pain. She's going to want to get that checked out. You know, it might be the kind of thing where they go in with a scope and take out 10% of her meniscus, and all of a sudden she feels like $1 million. In terms of ankles, cracks, and crunches, you know, she's going to have to figure out whether those crunches and clicks and things like that are actually like a pathology, or if they're just a little bit of crepitus, which is very, very common. But all things considered, when you look at the knee, what you really have to do is just consider that it's kind of the bastard child of the hip and the ankle, right? And Mike did a great job with his Bulletproof Knees manual on this, is that, you know, you need to work on hip mobility and ankle mobility. You know, and that with the ankle, it's a function of both joint mobilization positions, and also just working on actual flexibility of the Achilles itself. Both of those are going to play into, you know, how stable your knee joint is. So when I deal with the knee, it's more about, all right, we got to find single leg exercises that people can do safely. And in her case, that's going to be more of a split squat isometric holds, and also possibly some reverse lunges. At the same time, we're going to work on hip and ankle mobility, glute activation, things along those lines. So there are definitely a lot of things that go into it, but I think, you know, above all, she needs to, you know, drop some body fat. When she talks about wearing orthotics for her feet, I have, you know, kind of a mixed feeling about that. You know, she's got a lift in one shoe. Is that because she has a functional imbalance, that's developed over the past few years, or is it because of a structural imbalance? Most people have flat feet, and my feeling is if your feet can go flat, they can go unflat too. So, I think barefoot training is an option for pretty much everybody. We do it with people who wear orthotics. Even just getting a little bit of sensory feedback can make a big difference, because our feet have been jammed into shoes for way too long, and anything we can do in our bare feet, even if it's just a little bit here and there, is going to make a big difference in terms of strengthening those intrinsic muscles of the feet.
Very good. Is there anything, as always, you guys, I want you to jump in if you want to jump in on any of these questions.
Real quick, Kev, I think we lost Jimmy.
Oh, we did. So
you might want to call him back, because he's kind of quiet, and he just texted me saying he's not on anymore.
Yeah, I was wondering, this day Jimmy Smith hasn't been yelling about anything in the last... people tell me I have to be nicer to Jimmy, but Jimmy, are you back with us?
You don't have to be nicer to me, you just have to notice when I drop off the show.
Sorry, I was kind of really... going into the conversation, it was really interesting.
You enthralled in the conversation. I was like, because it was weird. I was about to ask her a question, and then all of a sudden you jumped in. I was like, this son of a bitch. And then
Well, that's Jimmy, all. It's the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Real quick, Eric, you had mentioned that you talked about the plant leg. What are you seeing when you look at their feet and their toes? Because I know when you look at the plant leg of a pitcher, you see some really funky things on the bottom there. So I just want to see what you find.
Yeah, you know, it's not tremendously remarkable as compared to what you see in the normal population. Like, for me, in the grand scheme of things, when I deal with a pitcher, it's about treating the athlete, or, you know, basically working with an athlete rather than a pitcher per se. So a lot of times you're going to see the same type of callus patterns that you would see in a pronator versus a supinator. So typically, you know, you're going to see actually a little bit more supination if you're going to see anything on that plant leg, simply because it's so trained for rigidity, right? Because a supinator is going to be, you know, basically propelling you, whereas the front leg is going to have to do a lot more deceleration. So you're expecting to see a little bit more pronation. So a lot of times with that front leg, you'll see a lot more like internal rotation going on at tibia and at femur, just to help decelerate that that knee flexion and the pronation that's occurring. So you got to be cautious about making sure that, you know, you don't get really balled up in lateral hamstrings on that front leg and things like that. So generally speaking, on the whole, you're going to see a lot more just tightness on that plant leg, and that's how guys usually feel. And some soft tissue work and just a little bit extra flexibility stuff can really make a big difference. But callus patterns are you know, going to be really comparable to what you'll see in the normal population, whether it's a sprinter or anything like that. So, you know, if someone's a supinator, we're looking at callus patterns at the base of the first and the fifth toes. If someone's pronating a little bit more, you're looking for stuff at the base of the index and the middle toes, for lack of a better term. So those are kind of what I'm always spotting for, and I actually start all my assessments with those, and they tell us quite a bit about what's going on. So.
Good stuff. Is there anything anyone else wanted to add before we move on to the next question?
No, I'm good.
I'm good.
Jen,
good.
Are you still there? Jen?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah.
All right, just checking. Next up, a question comes from our good friend Mike. He asks, for people who spend most of the day in front of a computer, what are some mobilizations or corrective exercises that can be performed at the desk? And also, how often should people do these?
Well, if you look at creep, you know, Stuart McGill's talked about it with respect to lower back issues. The numbers that have been thrown around in the various places I've heard are anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes before you get that negative change in tissue length that helps you to stabilize. So I think getting people up as often as possible, every 20 to 30 minutes is awesome. You know, 30 minutes is probably a little bit more ideal for most people in terms of just the logistics of moving around. So the more you can get up, the better. But, you know, at the same time, this question kind of speaks to what can you do in front of a computer. What can you actually do at the desk? You know, there's not a ton you can do sitting down. One of the ideas is you need to stand up. You know, the idea is we're stuck in hip flexion, we're stuck in knee flexion, and a lot of us are stuck up on our toes. Like, the single best thing you can do is stand up. There's some stuff you can do in terms of just basic thoracic spine mobilizations, similar to what you would do on a foam roller. I've also seen them done. Kind of the Z Health approach is very, very good, one that you can do seated for loosening up that thoracic spine. But more than anything, I think that the single best thing that people can do is actually just stand up. Take a trip to the restroom or go to fill your water bottle or do something like that, because the sitting is the problem in and of itself.
Good stuff. And is there anything else that people want to throw in before we kind of start to wrap this thing up?
I was just going to throw in, I agree with Eric. I mean, I try to tell my clients that are in front of computers all day, just get up and move, look for an excuse to get up. I think it was Bill Hartman that wrote about, setting your Outlook mail to alarm you every 20 minutes and just as a reminder to get up and move around. I have clients that sit in meetings for 4 to 5 hours at a time and never move. And they walk into me and wonder why they're in pain. And, just moving around and getting up every once in a while could reverse a lot of that before they even get to me. So I just think that's an important point to drive in.
Jimmy, you were saying something?
No, I said Eric really hit the nail on the head with a lot of the questions. So like Keith just said, he talks about people that sit at a computer all the time. And that was another great point. They have to get up and move around. And that's the whole thing.
Good stuff. Lastly, I want to quickly mention for the contest for the Black Star Labs Cytofuse this week, the winner was Lou Brady. So, Lou, send me an email with your address, and I will get that Cytofuse out to you, and I'll even throw in a couple T-shirts. So let me know what size T-shirt you want, and I'll throw in one, and I'll throw in two for friends of yours. So we can get those T-shirts out in the open, those limited edition John Williams and Kevin Larrabee T-shirts that are going fast. Well, before we do completely finish up, Eric, I just want to ask you, where can people just learn more about you, check out some of your stuff?
Probably the best bet is at ericcressey.com. It's ericcressey.com. Going to be on the road a little bit this month, doing a seminar down in New York City at Equinox. That's on the schedule on my website as well. So it's going to be a good bet to come by and check out. Geraldine Coopersmith is organizing that for their employees' as continuing education. And they decided to open that up to the public. But beyond that, yeah, just probably my website is kind of the best central place to catch everything. And I try to centralize all my stuff there to keep things logistically easier for me too. So that's probably the best bet.
Good stuff. Make sure to check that out. And also, Eric has new stuff on his blog every day. It's Eric Cressey at blogspot.com, right?
Correct. I totally forgot to mention that. Thank you, Kevin.
I just want to throw it in there. It's someplace that I head to every day first thing in the morning. So it's really nice to get some good stuff.
Thanks, pal.
No problem. Well, Jen, I want to ask you quickly, what did you think about Transformers before we go, for all the fans of movies out there?
I love X-Men, I love Pirates, I love these movies, but Transformers by far took the cake. I wanted to sit down and watch it immediately as soon as it was over. And that has never happened to me when I've watched a movie, ever. No movie ever have I finished and immediately wanted to start it again. It was so badass. I can't even tell you.
That's why you can pirate it off the internet. We don't do that on the Fake Ass. Jimmy Smith, it seems like you had a great time at the movie too.
I didn't have that great of time. I thought it was a great movie.
So you're not going to name your first child?
No. Like, I thought it was good. I thought that it was really funny. It had, like, a lot of tongue-in-cheek kind of humor in there, too, so you had to be able to catch. I mean, there were some parts I was laughing out loud, but it was cool.
Well, that's good. And you guys see the new Die Hard? I saw that on Friday.
Good stuff. I haven't seen a movie in months.
Neither have I.
I'm going to catch up on all my movies once the summer's over and I can actually get some sleep. For now, I'll live vicariously through Tony, I think.
Yeah, wow, Tony's our resident movie guy. He's our Rotten Tomatoes guy. We got to hopefully talk to him next week. Eric, do you know if he saw the movie?
I don't think he has, but I'm sure he'll be out there checking it out pretty soon. But at least doing like all the pre-screening for us, so we can not waste our time on the ones that aren't any good. So. Summer's usually good for this.
Very well put. Well,
hey, real quick, I got an email the other day from someone, and I just wanted to read part of it. It said, "Please come back on the FitCast. It needs someone to turn back the tide of anarchy." I have no idea what that means.
Wait, I got something. Can I say something now?
I'm going to forward
every single person here an email if they don't believe me. I got an email from someone saying the FitCast should be named after me because of how I make fun of Kevin. So that's all I'm going to say.
Hey, you know what? Most of the time, it's well-warranted. Jimmy Smith is an incredibly bright guy, and I'm willing to take crap from him every day because I know 99% of the time he's going to be right. It's just that 1% where he's wrong where I have to call him out for it.
And well, every third word you say, your voice cracks. It's hard not to call you out on that.
Hey, you know what? I'm trying to get through it. I'm sorry. I don't have a deep voice like James Earl
Kevin,
Jones.
Kev, as soon as the T levels kick in, it'll stop. Just give it a chance.
I'm waiting for it. I might.
Secret is to make it work for you, Kev. Just remember, like Joe from New Kids on the Block.
Yeah.
And KOTB reference.
Wow.
We'll talk about it on Monday.
can we leave with Hangin' Tough playing in the background this week?
Sure, but New Kids on the Block, that was even almost before my time. I mean, I had the tape when I was growing up, but I didn't really.
You're way too young for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think it's a good time for us to get out of here this week before the show goes on too long and we put everyone out there to sleep. So we're going to get out of here for episode number 57. My name is Kevin Larrabee.
Oh, I'm Keith.
Go ahead.
This is Gen Z.
All right. Come on. We can do this, guys. We can do this. We'll have Eric go last because he's our special guest. But I'm Kevin Larrabee.
I'm Jen Heath.
I'm Keith Scott.
I'm Jimmy Smith.
And I'm Eric Cressy.
And we're getting out of here. We'll see you next week. Don't forget to check out Eric's site at ericcressy.com. Check out thefitcast.com for daily articles. And I guess we're going to leave with some music from Jimmy Smith's recommendations. We'll see you next time. Song.